progressively increasing proportion, the oil she cannot do without and is no longer able to furnish from her own store. Besides being naive, Edgar was impolitic. Still, Britain now took oil seriously. Also in 1921, Lord Curzon, Britain's foreign secretary, dismissed U.S. demands on behalf of Standard Oil. No concessions, he said, would be allowed to American companies in Mesopotamia or elsewhere in the British Middle East. The United States, Curzon suggested, already had all the oil it needed. By this point, Washington, too, acted as if it half-owned Standard Oil, and national honor was at stake. The State Department pressed the British and Dutch with counter-threats. Congress, already launching investigations, could decide to prohibit oil investments by foreigners or to designate British and Dutch-owned U.S. oil fields as naval reserves, so as to bar any resale. The Bank of England also depended on U.S. central bankers supporting the wobbly British pound, as the New York Federal Reserve Bank did several times during the 1920s. By 1925, both explicit and veiled pressures from Washington had obliged Britain to open up Iraq to Standard of New Jersey and Saucony. The two received a 20% share in the new Iraq Petroleum Company. Standard of New Jersey also took over the former German oil concessions in the Dutch East Indies. One American historian has pithily summarized, "To some, these successive intercessions in behalf of oil were viewed as fulfilling the moral purposes and political needs of the natural overseas extension of 19th-century manifest destiny. To the less reverent, they earned Charles E. Hughes, Secretary of State from 1921 to 1925, the title of Secretary for Oil. And more significantly, these moves announced that the United States and its corporate citizens were now in truth world powers, with continuing economic interests on every continent. Looking back from the 21st century, we can call oil supremacy a game the United States always played to win." Herbert Hoover, the oil-wise U.S. Commerce Secretary, would have welcomed sharing Hughes's putative title. By one brisk interpretation, he privately asked Standard Oil of New Jersey to ingratiate itself with Arab culture and turn the oil sheiks away from the Brits and Germans toward the red, white, and blue. Or as one Gulf Oil executive recalled, representatives of the industry were called to Washington and told to go out and get it. Within a decade or so, American dealmakers had taken their cue. In 1927, Pittsburgh-headquartered Gulf, owned by the family of Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, bought the oil concession in Kuwait, soon taking the Anglo-Persian Oil Company into partnership there to satisfy the British. The next year, SoCal won the franchise in Bahrain, and by 1933, it had also arranged a concession from Saudi ruler Abdulaziz ibn Saud, whose territory had unwisely been ignored by the British. Then in 1936, SoCal and Texaco negotiated a deal to split the combined Saudi Arabian and Bahraini concession evenly between them, for which SoCal in return picked up a share of Texaco's fields in the Dutch East Indies. 2 years later, the left-leaning Mexican government of President Lázaro Cárdenas nationalized foreign oil holdings, squeezing the British out of another nation where they had made strong inroads before 1914. Though still 90% coal burning at home, Britain did significantly enlarge its overseas oil resources between the world wars. Nevertheless, as important Middle East producers took on American relationships, the United Kingdom lost any real hope of perpetuating its economic hegemony into the new oil era. Indeed, it fell short well before the deeper dislocations that accompanied World War II. By the 30s, U.S. oil companies overseas found themselves in quasi-official positions roughly comparable to those of Royal Dutch, Shell, and Anglo-Persian in the British orbit. Senior American oilmen were a kind of auxiliary diplomatic and foreign service, while the firms themselves could count on Washington help. In The Seven Sisters, Anthony Sampson concluded that, to radical critics, it looked as if the State Department had simply abdicated the whole process of oil diplomacy to the oilmen. The government, however much they might distrust the oilmen, were not prepared to set up their own organization. They preferred to use the oil companies, at a discreet distance, as the instruments of national security and foreign policy. No other U.S. industry had a comparable position. The Second World War, which was also rife with petroleum objectives and rivalries, fully established the United States as both global oil hegemon and economic commander-in-chief of the West. This eased, although it did not end, the old oil squabbles with the British and French. However, strategists in the State Department, the Pentagon, and headquarters of the U.S. oil giants well knew that another wrenching adjustment loomed. While at war from 1941 to 1945, the United States had been drawing down its own oil, while one geological survey after another identified the Middle East, with the world's biggest reserves, as the next great regional supplier. The 50s and 60s were to provide a relative lull. Then the unique relationship between oil and government in the United States would once again take center stage. Not that Americans of 1952 or even 1966 worried about this much. The Cold War was the obvious threat, the Soviet Union the great enemy. The Middle East, at least in the minds of Long Island or Peoria, was still the Hollywood movie set of Casbahs and camel drivers. Equal complacency guided the U.S. automobile culture of oversized cars with oversized tail fins, as well as the oil-burning proliferation of airlines, suburbs, and regional shopping centers. However, before we turn to the 1970s and the subsequent three-decade rise of petroleum-driven U.S. foreign policy, and two presidential generations of the oil-backed Bush family, it is necessary to consider another dimension. The buoyant but ultimately parochial political culture that developed around oil, its local production, and its vast consumption in the 20th century United States. Oil and automobile culture and 21st century American politics. After 150 years of national exuberance, most Americans cannot be expected to easily separate oil's uncertain future from its prolific past. The romance of gushers and boomtowns, the march of the population across the continent, the fuel supply that never lost its abundance, a citizenry far more residentially and vocationally mobile than their European ancestors, and the endless celebration of the open road, to say nothing of nearly a century of national success. Memories are becoming dangerously nostalgic. Whatever their great-grandparents thought of John D. Rockefeller, whatever their parents thought or still think of big oil, 21st century Americans display a growing fondness for the old gusher sites, gas stations, and Gulf, Esso, and Mobil signs. Museums are proliferating, especially in the leading energy states, gathering what Europeans might call the detritus of empire. The last of the old Kern County, California oil derricks, a shell-shaped shell service station from the 1920s, replicas of World War II oil tankers, ancient gas pumps with ancient prices, and yellowed newspaper headlines touting the flag-bedecked opening of the Pennsylvania Turnpike in 1940 or the crowd that raced out from Beaumont in 1901 to see Spindletop spout. The California Oil Museum outside Los Angeles, capital of America's highway mentality, takes pride in its collection of gas station artifacts. Particular nostalgia seems to attach to architecture of America's post-World War II automotive heyday. Drive-in movies and hamburger joints, roadhouses and ancient motels, as well as gas stations meticulously restored to their 1947 or 1954 appearance. Ohio, for example, is home to a thriving Society for Commercial Archaeology. The spring 2004 issue of its journal featured an article on early neon signs, the landscape of spinning sombreros and electrified teepees, restoring New Mexico's Route 66 signs. Washington State, in turn, has a lost highway museum, while a St. Louis firm called Primarily Petroliana handles oil and gas swap meets and auctions, featuring gas station antiques, oil industry collectibles, and auto industry memorabilia. Clearly, the reminiscence is fond. The United States has 15 to 20 widely listed oil and gas museums and 30 or so less noted county and regional facilities. Of the total, more than half are in Texas, Oklahoma, California, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, and Kansas. Unusual exhibits range from the offshore oil rig Mr. Charlie, open to the public at the International Petroleum Museum and Exposition in Morgan City, Louisiana, to the collection of 15 Spindletop-related buildings at Texas's Spindletop Gladys City Boomtown Museum. The pride of each local oil culture is palpable. Ohioans date their state's oldest drilled well to 1814, but it was sunk in pursuit of salt. The Oil and Gas Museum in West Virginia, in turn, says that its oldest well, at Burning Springs near Parkersburg, dates to 1860, while nearby oil operations may antedate Pennsylvania's 1859 strike. The Norman No. 1 Museum in Neodesha, Kansas, boasts a replica of what was supposedly the oldest drilled well west of the Mississippi. Little-known bits of Petroliana appear everywhere. The California Oil Museum, headquartered in Union Oil's 1890 office building, has an exhibit showing how Native Americans used oil seeps. Curators in Louisiana insist that oil was first discovered locally by the 1543 expedition of Hernando de Soto. The Oil and Gas Museum, Appalachian and contentious, describes George Washington as the first petroleum industry speculator by dint of his 1771 purchase of 250 acres in what was then Virginia that had an oil and gas spring. Enthralled readers can subscribe to Oil Industry History, published in Meadville, Pennsylvania, or Check the Oil, a journal of American Petroliana. I emphasize this petroculture not for its own sake, but for several larger reasons. First, the obvious politics of local pride and affectionate memory, which reaffirms the intensity of the decisive energy culture. Second, the striking resemblance to the latter-day memory lanes of two other great energy cultures that changed too little or too late. Britain has dozens of major coal and railway museums, thickest in the north of England, where coal midwived the first railway steam engine and where the Industrial Revolution unfolded during the first half of the 19th century. In those years, Britain produced and consumed more than half of the world's coal. The Dutch take the same pride in their sturdy dikes and well-preserved 17th and 18th century windmills, some 1,000 of which still stand. These, too, are prime attractions for visitors, the best being grouped into six open-air museum parks. 250 years ago, the Zaan district just outside Amsterdam was Europe's first industrial complex, with 900 or so windmills. Some survivors were famous enough in their day to have nicknames like De Kat, a grinder of coloring materials, and De Schoolmeester, reputed source of the parchment used for the American Declaration of Independence. The larger point, of course, is that because the 21st century United States has a pervasive oil and gas culture from its own earlier zenith, with an intact cultural and psychological infrastructure, it's no surprise that Americans cling to and defend an ingrained fuel habit. Many of the museums and exhibits date from the 1980s. The hardening of old attitudes and reaffirmation of the consumption ethic since those years may signal an inability to turn back. The chance to do so came a quarter century ago. From the late 70s to the early 80s, oil consumption in the United States underwent a powerful reversal. Energy-using Americans had been scared. In 1976, the political combination of the Watergate scandal, the energy crisis, inflation, economic recession, and military collapse in South Vietnam, 1975, dominated that year's election and cost Republicans the White House, albeit only by a thin margin. The new Democratic chief executive, former Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter, by vocation a peanut grower and by religious belief a Sunday school teaching Baptist, had campaigned on a reformist vision. Even Texas gave him a narrow victory, casting its final 20th century vote for a Democratic president. Forswearing the trappings of the imperial presidency, Carter left his limousine to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue on Inauguration Day in January 1977. Weeks later, he made an energy speech on television wearing a cardigan sweater. In mid-1979, the embattled president underscored the second OPEC oil crisis by asking for the most massive peacetime commitment of funds and resources in our nation's history to develop America's own alternative sources of fuel from coal, from oil shale, from plant products for gasohol, from unconventional gas, from the sun. Nixon, before being completely overwhelmed by Watergate, had taken a similar but less ambitious tack on energy independence. Soon thereafter, Congress passed the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975, which, among other things, mandated a doubling of passenger car fuel economy by 1985. Carter went farther in 1977, declaring the moral equivalent of war. The ideology and culture of the four Carter years were broadly anti-imperial, as they stressed energy conservation, peace rather than arms sales in the Middle East, skepticism of CIA clandestine operations and the overthrow of foreign governments, reduced conspicuous consumption, federal missionary work on behalf of solar power and renewable energy sources, smaller automobiles, and the enactment of a 55-mile-per-hour federal speed limit. Carter also promoted government restraint in budgetary matters and a vague attempt to crystallize less is more and smaller is better viewpoints, both of these in opposition to earlier mandates to spend, build, produce, and consume. Militarily, the Carter White House spoke softly and also managed to carry a pretty small stick. After the revolutionary government of Iran in 1979 seized 53 Americans from the U.S. Embassy, the air rescue mission Carter ordered in the spring of 1980 failed. With the helicopters downed in the Iranian desert, a symbol of his greater ineptitude, Carter lost the 1980 election and is remembered as a weak president. The 1975 to 1985 revolution in energy efficiency, however, was a relative success. Together with spiking oil prices, a conservationist ethic tightened America's energy belt. Between 1977 and 1985, and in the face of an expanding economy, oil demand fell by more than one-sixth. The percentage of oil consumed in the United States annually that had to be imported shrank from 46% to 30%. Inasmuch as two-thirds of the petroleum used in the United States went to keep automobiles on the road, the CAFE standards enacted in 1975 were a linchpin in this reduction. Where the average car in the United States got just 15 miles per gallon that year, the figure by 1985 was 25. California was in the forefront, having followed Governor Jerry Brown's call to move away from dependence on non-renewable fossil fuels. Nationally, new homes were often twice as energy efficient as similar-sized predecessors. Appliances made even bigger gains. New refrigerators, for example, used only one-quarter the power of pre-1970s models. As for the U.S. manufacturing sector as a whole, its energy efficiency improved by 30% between 1977 and 1986. The conservation weapon, once fired, was probably at least as efficient as the military option would have been. With roots in different economic and energy cultures, conservatives and liberals were inclined to ignore the other side's partial successes, preferring to resort to caricature. Republicans quipped that Carter's call for energy conservation as the moral equivalent of war could be summed up by its acronym, MEOW. Absent a policy synthesis and compromise, the complex of economic, lifestyle, and foreign policy issues that propelled U.S. oil politics swung in the conservative direction again. By the mid-1980s, support for energy conservation was ebbing. For one thing, the Reagan-Bush administration had been lukewarm to it, reducing spending on solar energy by two-thirds, de-emphasizing efficiency, and moving the spotlight back to petroleum. Nevertheless, as things turned out, the Republicans' 1981 emphasis on increasing oil supply as a means of lowering prices was justifiable, just like Carter's 1977 focus on efficiency and alternative fuels. Market forces rewarded the GOP emphasis. As the OPEC nations responded to U.S. urgings or simply produced oil in quantities far beyond their quotas, prices fell. Over 5 years, they declined by roughly two-thirds, from $31 to $35 per barrel in 1981, to $27 to $30 in late 1985, and to just $10 to $11 at the low point in 1986. Steep enough to devastate many Texas producers, this collapse quickly made irrelevant the 1980 to 1981 cost comparisons between oil and alternative energy sources. Hundreds of Texas oil men filed for bankruptcy, Houston real estate plummeted, and the bottom fell out of the market for cowboy art. But in the nation as a whole, oil made a comeback with consumers by regaining price acceptability. plummeting oil and gasoline prices soon put the ignition key back into the great American automobile culture. Further federal tightening of fuel economy standards was rejected in 1985, and Detroit also took advantage of the statute's permissive standards for light trucks by developing its soon-to-be bestsellers, sport utility vehicles. For 10 years, technological improvement had concentrated on fuel economy. Now automobile manufacturers return to their pre-1973 priorities: power, acceleration, and speed. American foreign policy also hit the accelerator as the Reagan and Bush administrations mounted a series of punitive expeditions against provocative foreign regimes, from Grenada, 1983, and Libya, 1986, to Panama, 1989, and Iraq, 1990-1991. The embrace of high-powered automobiles, airstrikes, and invasions, all departures from the Carter mindset, drew on distinctly Republican values. The war to expel Iraq from Kuwait was oil-related, undertaken in part to protect the American lifestyle, as President George H.W. Bush acknowledged. Once military power had secured Middle Eastern oil supplies again, television news clips showed the 41st president roaring along the Maine coast at the wheel of his rakish, high-speed cigarette boat, Fidelity. The broader symbolism leaped out. Guilt complexes and hair shirts were gone, and with a Texas Republican at the helm, the United States was back to practicing gunboat diplomacy and taking what it wanted. The election of Bill Clinton in 1992 made surprisingly little difference. The sort of Bubba Democrat who had a wink in his eye and often an AstroTurf cushion in the back of his bachelor pickup truck, Clinton kept the U.S. air patrols flying over Iraq, launched occasional missile strikes, and domestically sought to make the good times roll. The auto manufacturers did their part. SUVs rolled off the production lines in steadily increasing numbers. By 1999, 48.3% of the new sales in the U.S. automobile market came from minivans, light trucks, and SUVs. Hair shirts made no comeback in 2000 either. On the contrary, Americans were driving more miles in bigger cars, living in even more remote suburbs, and, when they could afford them, buying larger, showier, gadget-stuffed houses at least twice as energy-intensive as those in Europe and Japan. In the late 90s, as the stock market bubble swelled toward its 2000 puncture, investors were especially drawn to new varieties of conspicuous consumption, backstopped by the belief that technology had initiated a new era of prosperity and U.S. supremacy. In destroying the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, Al-Qaeda struck at a nation already concerned about the economic implications of the 2000 stock market slide, and the bounce back of oil prices to the $30 per barrel range after touching lows near $10 in 1998. Under George W. Bush, petroleum and security issues become intertwined to a degree that favored the Republicans in the same way as the 1980s fatigue with Carter-type energy politics had. To a majority of the public, conservation was overshadowed by support for more two-fisted responses to the energy problem, and even activists had become reluctant to use the term because of its image as a 1970s relic. Most of all, an oil, automobile, and national security coalition had taken the driver's seat in Washington. The president and vice president came from the oil industry, and the White House chief of staff, Andrew Card, was the former president of the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. The Hydrocarbon Coalition and the 2004 election. By any serious historical standard, George W. Bush won a tight race in 2004. Yet its closeness was revealing, following an intense, if rarely candid, election year discussion of American security, including the supposed benefit of preemptive Middle Eastern invasions in preventing terror attacks and diminished lifestyles at home. Narrow margins tend to highlight polarizations. George W. Bush did not carry the states where most of the September 11th victims had lived. New York's and New Jersey's experiences with damage and death were not decisive election factors. Religious divisions, striking indeed, were more influential and will be analyzed in Part 2. Yet among the factors that had spurred the GOP electorate, a vital backdrop for the next chapter's discussion of petro-imperialism, one can discern several surprisingly influential oil, gasoline, and automobile relationships. A large number of voters work in or depend on energy and automobile industries, and still more are invested in them, not just financially, but emotionally and culturally. These secondary cadres included racing fans, hobbyists, collectors, and dedicated readers of automotive magazines, as well as the tens of millions of automobile commuters from suburbs and distant exurbs, plus the high number of drivers whose strong self-identifications with vehicle types and models serve as thinly disguised political statements. In analyzing the Bush coalition, we can start with energy's influence as an enterprise. For the most part, the oil, gas, and coal regions were in red states. Of the top 10 oil and gas producers, California alone, atypical in its parallel sensitivity to conservation themes and electricity overcharges, supported Democrat John Kerry in 2004. The Bush Energy Coalition also included coal, an industry and workforce particularly vulnerable to environmentalists' hostility and proposed agendas on carbon dioxide emissions. Just two of the top 10 coal states backed Kerry: Pennsylvania, 4, and Illinois, 7. Three coal producers, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee, were among the states giving Bush his biggest gains between 2000 and 2004, although evangelical and fundamentalist religion may be the larger explanation. States with little or no oil, gas, or coal output, by contrast, ranked high in the Kerry block. On the 2004 electoral map, the Heartland Hydrocarbon or Fossil Fuels Coalition displayed a bolder profile than it had 4 years earlier. The U.S. car culture has strong regionalisms. The 13 states with 75-mile-per-hour speed limits, 8 in the Mountain West, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, all lopsidedly backed George W. Bush for re-election. Fast-shooting country is also fast-driving country. None of these states backed Jimmy Carter in 1980 either. As for automobile manufacturing employment, the leading states, Ohio, Michigan, and Illinois, divided their electoral votes between the parties in 2004. However, because they are closely balanced electoral pivots, analysts assume that they, Ohio and Michigan in particular, can swing on an issue that puts the industry at risk. Fuel economy standards tough enough to threaten America's SUV production and culture might serve. Car preference turned out to be a revealing guide to presidential preference, according to a 2004 survey of 2,500 drivers sponsored by Kelley Blue Book, the Automobile Valuation Guide. Merely driving with any frequency, as opposed to bicycling, subway riding, or whatever, correlated among adults with a pro-GOP bias. Drivers polled 7 points more favorably for Bush than did the overall electorate. Predictably, the president led by a country mile among drivers of Fords, Chevrolets, large SUVs, and full-size pickup trucks, such as the Chevy Suburban or Ford F-Series. Smaller ad hoc samplings also put the Republican incumbent out front among upscale owners of Porsches, Jaguars, and large GM models. Readership samples of magazines such as Car and Driver, Motor Trend, and Road and Track, mostly male, would presumably have produced 2 or 3 to 1 pro-Bush margins. Kerry, besides winning non-drivers, prevailed narrowly among aficionados of convertibles, presumably youthful. He also led handily among those selecting fuel-efficient imports such as Toyotas and Subarus. Volvos, with their Swedish safety emphasis, have been the stereotyped liberal choice. But 5 out of 6 owners of fuel-saving hybrids picked the Massachusetts senator, his biggest edge. In the United States more than elsewhere, a preference for conspicuous consumption over energy efficiency and conservation is a signal of a much deeper central divide. Spectators at NASCAR events and other stock car races were wooed so ardently by the Bush campaign that their decision-making became the basis of an election year metaphor. In addition to attending races, George W. Bush sought NASCAR driver endorsements, enlisting top names to stump for him in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, and Michigan. One survey showed Bush with the support of 54% of NASCAR dads. defined as blue-collar males who watched at least one televised NASCAR race during the year. However, fans in the Speedway stands, the ultimate enthusiasts, were more lopsidedly supportive. Another White House effort pinpointed exurbanites, voters who live in remote suburbs and towns, many of them interstate corridor boomburbs full of new houses and recent arrivals. The newest residential classification, fully deployed by the Census Bureau in 2003, is micropolitan, coined to describe areas that lack the city of 50,000 people required for metropolitan status, but that are too urban to be rural. Like the other terms, micropolitan is too sweeping, but it steers our conceptions of these places in a useful direction. In states such as Ohio and Florida, such areas, increasingly identified with particular interstate highways, Florida's much-heralded I-4 corridor and Ohio's still unsung I-76, I-80, and I-71, are starting to have more voters than the often Democratic urban and inner suburban metropolitan areas. In Florida, Bush flew into sites along the I-4 and I-75 corridors for effective late campaign rallies. After the dust settled, Democratic and Republican consultants alike credited the NASCAR dads and security moms along I-4 for much of the GOP victory margin. Ohio saw Bush weaken in the big metropolitan counties compared to his showing in 2000, but his gains in the 29 micropolitan areas more than made up for it. Bush and Cheney both made final week stops in Wilmington, Ohio. Population just 12,187 in 2004, but a fast-growing node along the I-71 corridor between Cincinnati and Columbus. Some 573 micropolitan areas housed fully 1 out of 10 Americans at the time of the 2000 census, and according to Robert Lang, director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech, they backed Bush in 2004 61-39. 27 of Ohio's micropolitan areas went for Bush, and 10 of Florida's 11. Many micropolitan areas overlap with the nation's 100 fastest-growing counties, which are likewise pro-Bush. Instead of being affluent, most of these regions are middling in income and education, filled with young families, most of them white, many of modest means, willing to trade time for space, accepting longer commutes into urban areas so they can afford homes. According to a post-election examination of Ohio's Clinton County, where Wilmington is, some local newcomers drive to jobs in Dayton and Cincinnati and even an hour north to Columbus. If the Census Bureau ever profiles counties by per capita gasoline usage, these places will rank high, altogether appropriate for demographic products of the interstate highway system. Besides the innate thirst of SUVs, some of the last quarter century's surge in U.S. oil consumption has come from Americans driving more. Some 12,000 miles per motorist per year, up almost one-third from 1980, because they as a whole live farther from work. In consumption terms, exurbia is the physical result of the latest population redistribution enabled by car culture and the electorate that upholds it. In assessing their political motivations, coming years will see thousands of exurbanites, now a full 10% of the national electorate, stretched out, figuratively at least, on psychiatrists' couches and sociologists' survey sheets. Still, a few conclusions already seem obvious. Family values are central. If by this we mean having families and accepting lengthy commutes to install them in reasonably safe and well-churched places. In the 1970s, such households might have been fleeing school busing or central city crime. In the post-September 11th era, many sought distance from godless school systems or the random violence and terrorist attacks expected to occur in metropolitan areas. Although many of the migrants likely had conservative leanings to begin with, thereby taking a GOP vote out of Cleveland or Cincinnati even as they added one in a micropolitan area, religious and political socialization processes in the exurbs could be expected to intensify their views. In moving to small-town America, many shed earlier urban Democratic registrations. While SUVs became a particular phenomenon after the events of September 11th increased personal safety consciousness, other heavy vehicles also gained cachet. By 2003, the machismo emphasized by Detroit spread to large cars with names such as Dodge Viper and Mercury Marauder. Press accounts quoted buyers half-joking that they would have bought an Abrams tank had one been available. The Marauder VT version, indeed, boasted a 444-horsepower engine, about one-third the size of one of the engines propelling the World War II Martin B-26 Marauders flown on long-distance bombing raids against Japan. That's a lot of engine just to hit a sale at a suburban shopping mall. Nevertheless, the bigger psychological change after September 11th came among women, not men. Democratic pollster Celinda Lake reported in 2004 that women have almost twice the sense of risk as men do. They think a member of their family might be a victim of terrorism. Marketing executives generally concurred that married women saw big cars as protection for themselves and their children, not vehicles with which to work off road rage. By late 2003, according to Road and Track, 40% of the vehicles classified as trucks were being bought by women, and the election year survey for the Kelley Blue Book found Kerry trailing Bush by a 3-to-1 ratio among such security moms. The significance here is difficult to overstate. Election day and post-election polls for 2004 come in many flavors. The network exit polls, for example, put Kerry ahead. But sticking with Lake's survey is useful for focusing on women. Whereas men produced a small 2000 to 2004 Democratic gain, Kerry got 44% as opposed to Gore's 42%, security consciousness among women favored Bush. Here, Gore's 54% became Kerry's 51%, with the decline concentrated among married women, where Gore's 2-point lead in 2000 reversed into an 11-point Bush margin. Granted, there was a post-9/11 mood shift in the national climate. The emotional crystallization came from the Bush campaign's skill in stimulating apprehension among married mothers in middle-class urban, suburban, or exurban areas. Multidimensional fears of what might happen in their homes, in their cars, at their schools, or in any public place that terrorists might choose to attack. Single, childless women, by contrast, did not follow this pattern. For many national Democratic strategists whose screens ping at a 1-point rise in central city poverty or a scowl from Hollywood contributors, the angst of middle America, Hummer purchases by fearful housewives, micropolitan buildups along interstate highway corridors, NASCAR excitement, and a Pentecostal drift in the Hispanic lower middle class, apparently failed to register. By contrast, even such obscure but relevant data as county-level breakouts on the distribution of Florida's 350,000 concealed weapon permits was entered into shrewd Republican calculations of voter psychologies along the I-4. Fear was there to be tapped, and the Bush-Cheney team collected by the bucket. But tapping fear raises the hope that it can be ameliorated by the tappers. Failure, to be sure, would carry a high penalty. Should U.S. policies collapse in some oil supply cutoff, large-scale terrorist success, economic crash of the dollar, or deep disenchantment with White House misrepresentations, public anger could shift from Middle Eastern terrorists and oil dangers to deceit and incompetence in Washington and thus to the ballot box. Like a bicycle, the innately unsteady GOP coalition with such disparate elements is enormously dependent on forward motion. By the end of 2005, interstate corridor residents had a particular new discontent: soaring fuel prices. The Republican National Coalition's unusual outlook must be underscored by an additional energy-related point. Some 30-40% of the Bush electorate, many of whom might otherwise resent their employment conditions, credit card debt, heating bills, or escalating costs of automobile upkeep, from insurance to gas prices, subordinate these economic concerns to a broader religious preoccupation with biblical prophecy and the second coming of Jesus Christ. The explanation is mostly theological and will be pursued accordingly. But there is a strong connection to oil, gas, and energy, a tie that inhibits American policymaking deliberations. In 1983, James Watt, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, was forced to resign because of pressure from environmentalists who regarded him as hostile to their cause. Part of the suspicion lay in Watt's conservative religion. He was the first cabinet secretary to belong to the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, and in suppositions that he was preoccupied with waiting for Christ's second coming rather than with environmental stewardship. This was an early instance of a connection that has since become more controversial. An interest in Watt rekindled in 2001 when his protege, Coloradan Gale Norton, was named Secretary of the Interior by George W. Bush. Norton had worked for Watt at the Mountain States Legal Foundation in 1979 to 1981, and again at the Interior Department. Like Watt, she was seen by the environmental movement as a foe. Come 2004, Watt participated in a series of interviews conducted in Denver with former Interior Secretaries. His introduction, by Patricia Limerick of the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado, harked back two decades to his resignation. She noted that this person, Watt, did not say that because the Second Coming was imminent, we must squander and trash our resources. He said, since the Second Coming may be upon us, we must behave as good stewards in anticipation of that reckoning. The distinction is important given how critics have misquoted Watt, for which Bill Moyers and several major print media apologized in 2005. In practical terms, however, the new centrality of stewardship, the theology underpinning the religious right, environmental, and energy policy, likewise demands attention. Scholars of religious politics, such as University of Akron Professor John Green, describe those elements ignoring the environment as they wait for the rapture, or second coming, as a fringe movement. By sophisticated standards, that may be. However, like the widely held belief in Armageddon, fringe ideas touching the environment or natural resources may influence 15, 20, or even 30 million adults, and not a few are well-placed office holders. The Book of Genesis theology that true believers bring to bear on matters relative to the environment, global warming, carbon-based fuels, petroleum geology, and the age of the earth has a particular influence on congressmen, senators, cabinet officers, and presidents from states such as Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Wyoming, much as left liberal ideology commands its best access to politicians from Massachusetts, New York, and the Pacific Coast. Liberal Democrats, in mishandling the Watt debate, generally went for the easy mockery. Biblical worldview politicians waiting for the second coming, yuck yuck, while ignoring the existence of a powerful Republican, conservative, and theological infrastructure related to energy and environmental subject matter. Watt, in short, is only the tip of a politico-religious iceberg that is far larger now than it was when he left office in 1983. We will return more broadly to the new theology underpinning much of the Republican Party and its coalition in Part 2. What deserves attention in these chapters is the significance for U.S. energy and resource policies of the biblical worldview held by key conservative power brokers in Washington. In Congress, the two most notable are Texan Tom DeLay and Oklahoman James Inhofe, chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Both men call the Federal Environmental Protection Agency a Gestapo and have favored its abolition. In the Oval Office itself, Texan George W. Bush doubts evolution and global warming and believes in the Bible. The question is only one of degree. Evangelical religion is clearly beginning to inhibit science and geology. In recent years, as evangelicals have gained importance, corporations have begun to take note, hiring more Washington lobbyists with biblical worldviews or Christian right connections. In Texas and Oklahoma, and across the South and some Rocky Mountain states, the connections among the boardrooms, petroleum clubs, and conservative preachers are well established. Colorado is a particularly important example, given the relationship centered in the beer-rich Coors family. For three decades, and with considerable national significance, it has been at the junction of the religious right and laissez-faire natural resource, energy, and environmental policy. Brewer Joseph Coors, the founding father, at least in political terms, was closely involved during the 1970s and early 1980s in helping to fund and build four organizations that became linchpins of the GOP's business-religious axis. the Washington-based Heritage Foundation, the Mountain States Legal Foundation, the Council for National Policy, co-founded by preacher and author Tim LaHaye, and, more marginally, the Coalition on Revival, bridging the theological gap between the rapture believers and the Christian Reconstructionists who believe a theocratic type of government must be built before Jesus will return. Since the 1980s, the impact of this axis during Republican administrations has been particularly notable within the sections of the federal government that regulate the environment, mining, oil and petrochemicals, ranching, and logging. In short, the principal units charged with resources stewardship, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Departments of the Interior and Energy. Three Interior Secretaries, James Watt, Donald Hodel, later also Energy Secretary, and Gail Norton, at some point held positions in the Mountain States Legal Foundation or the Council on National Policy, as had Ann Gorsuch, a Reagan-era EPA administrator. All four have been associated with permissiveness toward regulated industries. Watt and Hodel, in turn, have been closely associated with the religious right. Hodel, after leaving government, held top positions in three related organizations: the Christian Coalition, the Council for National Policy, and the Colorado-based Focus on the Family. During the 1980s and much of the 1990s, little attention was paid, save for the Watt episode, to whether the pro-corporate or anti-environmentalist views of the four were ideological or theological. But that changed in the late 90s as religious right leaders and their allies were aroused by the criticisms put forward by liberal environmental groups and church organizations led by the National Council of Churches. These included charges that conservative fundamentalists and evangelicals cared little about the environment, preferring to rely on the biblical instruction in Genesis 1:28 to subdue the earth and have dominion over it. Such was the argument, for example, of Norman Geisler, president of the Southern Evangelical Seminary. Genesis, he says, gives us the divine mandate to use the resources that are there. Others thought that the old argument needed a little more polish. In 2000, a number of religious conservatives, including stalwarts Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention, James Dobson of Focus on the Family, and D. James Kennedy of Florida's Coral Ridge Ministries, launched a new organization called the Interfaith Council for Environmental Stewardship. Human beings, its declaration read, were given stewardship by God to be fruitful, to bring forth good things from the earth. Moreover, sound theology was needed to help guide the environmental decision-making process. Other council tenets and pronouncements emphasized private property rights and economic development. The moderate to liberal National Council of Churches, in turn, linked its 2004 pro-environmental drive to the organization of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, urging a brand of stewardship that paid more attention to global warming and less to left-behind literature. But even prominent centrist theologians took umbrage at conservative attitudes toward the environment. Martin Marty of the Institute for the Advanced Study of Religion at the University of Chicago did so defending a Lutheran colleague, Barbara Rossing, who had written a book calling the rapture a racket. Theologian Rossing, Marty wrote, was going back to a first love. Biblical understanding of the environment and ecology. She had better hurry. If the rapture people get their explosive Jesus the Terminator way, there may not be much environment left to be cared for. The evidence that natural resource issues are taking on theological as well as political overtones is mounting. As we will see, theology is creeping into ever more nooks and crannies of the national debate. Although the exact portion of the GOP electorate taking an end times view is unknowable, polls suggest that close to a majority of those who voted for Bush believe the Bible to be literally true. The most intense, high-intensity believers split into two principal camps. The first, so-called dispensationalists, who interpret current events such as tsunamis, oil spikes, and wars as confirming that end times are at hand, usually don't worry about energy policy. Indeed, they cite a biblical verse mentioning costly wheat, barley, and oil as predictions of shortages of food and fuel. In dispensationalist Tim LaHaye's best-selling Left Behind series, some of his heroes obtain SUVs to go off-road during the earthquakes of the tribulation. Reconstructionists, by contrast, believe that the world must be made over theocratically, along biblical lines, before Christ will return. Neither faction has fossil fuels, climate deterioration, or the energy efficiency of the U.S. manufacturing sector on its agenda. Both camps deplore the efforts of geologists and climatologists to sway voters and policymakers through Hubbert peak analyses and scientific interpretations of global warming data. Their biblically viewed world is at most 10,000 years old, not the millions of years established by scientists, for insistence on this longer time frame is said to usurp God's prerogative. In considering stem cell research or Iraq as Babylon, depleting oil or melting polar ice caps, the thought processes of such true believers have only limited openness to any national secular dialogue. The Republican Party entertains no such public debate. Economic conservatives in the oil and gas, coal, and automobile industries may not believe in end times, but their opposition to regulatory environmental prescriptions and tougher fuel efficiency standards makes them ally with the economically undemanding religious right. This facet of current U.S. energy politics may yet turn out to be one of the most pernicious. No leading world economic power has ever maintained itself on the cutting edge of innovation and development with a political coalition that panders to biblical inerrancy. But we are getting ahead of our narrative. George W. Bush has been in the White House only for weeks, and he is looking for a chance to attack Iraq. It is time to turn to the new fusion of oil, foreign policy, and overseas military intervention that has come together in what can be called petro-imperialism. Chapter 3. Trumpets of Democracy, Drums of Gasoline. Oil has literally made foreign and security policy for decades. Just since the turn of this century, it has provoked the division of the Middle East after World War I, aroused Germany and Japan to extend their tentacles beyond their borders, the Arab oil embargo, Iran versus Iraq, the Gulf War. This is all clear. Bill Richardson, U.S. Secretary of Energy, 1999. A quick look at the map is all it takes. It's no coincidence that the map of terror in the Middle East and Central Asia is practically interchangeable with the map of oil. There's infinite justice, enduring freedom, and everlasting profits to be made. Asia Times, 2002. The need to dominate oil from Iraq is also deeply intertwined with the defense of the dollar. Its current strength is supported by OPEC's requirement, secured by a secret agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, that all OPEC sales be denominated in dollars. Peter Dale Scott, 2003. He, Karl Rove, turned out millions of the foot soldiers on November 2nd, including many who have made the apocalypse a powerful driving force in modern American politics. It's why the invasion of Iraq was for them a warm-up act, predicted in the Book of Revelation. A war with Islam in the Middle East is not something to be feared, but welcomed. An essential conflagration on the road to redemption. Bill Moyers, 2004. Each epigraph above distills a different aspect of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. They are all compatible, though, because the attack, while at bottom about access to oil and U.S. global supremacy, had other intentions. One was to fold oil objectives into the global war against terror. A second was to cement the U.S. dollar's hegemonic role in global oil sales, and thus in the world economy. A third was to keep the invasion's purpose broad enough to allow the biblically minded Christian right to see it, at least partially, as a destruction of the New Babylon on the road to Armageddon and redemption. None of these motivations excuse the fundamental deceits of Anglo-American policymakers. Speaking on behalf of George W. Bush, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer insisted on February 6, 2003, that if this had anything to do with oil, the position of the United States would be to lift the sanctions so the oil could flow. This is not about that. This is about saving lives by protecting the American people. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had, in November 2002, likewise declared that it has nothing to do with oil. Literally nothing to do with oil. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, for his part, told members of Parliament in early 2003, "Let me deal with the conspiracy theory idea that this is somehow to do with oil. There is no way whatever, if oil were the issue, that it would not be infinitely simpler to cut a deal with Saddam." All three statements, each of which came back to haunt its maker, are all but lies. Oil was a critical factor. The thin, partial truth of these denials, very thin, very partial, lay in the fact that broader concerns were also at work. For one thing, as we will see, the Bush administration knew that the oil peak crisis probably posed strategic dangers far beyond those publicly acknowledged. The dollar's role as the world's reserve currency was also tied to oil. Besides which, seizing Iraq as a military base cum oil reservoir would allow U.S. troops to be pulled out of vulnerable Saudi Arabia, where their presence was breeding discontent and terrorism. At the same time, biblically attuned pro-war constituencies would have been alienated by any emphasis on oil or any oil-related peril to the U.S. dollar. In the Left Behind series, which religious right leader Jerry Falwell called the most influential books since the Bible, the godly heroes did not deal in oil. Only the malevolent Antichrist, based in New Babylon, did that. This aligns with the insistence that the United States and Britain were fighting not for oil, heaven forfend, or to stop OPEC or Islamic leaders from pricing petroleum in euros, but to bring freedom, liberty, and democracy to the Middle East. This hoary claim, the pedigree of which dates to the post-World War I period and the phraseology of President Woodrow Wilson and the British Foreign Secretary Lord Curzon, bears little relation to the last century of actual Anglo-American regional involvement. As the drumbeat for war in Iraq sounded in 2002 and early 2003, part of the ensuing confusion arose because practically none of the true stakes or political motivations were acknowledged. Oil, the oil-linked value of the dollar, and religious expectations alike. But 100 years of petro-imperialism in the Persian Gulf were about to come to a head. The Hundred Years' Oil War. The idea of a latter-day Hundred Years' War does not sit easily in the contemporary mind. We think of our technology-fed world as too fast, too intense to permit such a long engagement. The only Hundred Years' War generally recognized in Western history is the one fought in Western France between 1337 and 1453. Over that long century, the French generally squeezed out the English, whose rulers also claimed to be kings of France. The English general defeated in 1453, John Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury, was a famous knight whose name lives on in that of an estimable Bordeaux wine. Medieval warfare centers such as Chateau Castelnau and Bayac on the Dordogne add to the lure of Perigord vintages and Michelin stars. Enjoyable travel routes and tours help bring pleasure and history together. Perhaps one day visitors will drive up the Tigris River to tour sites and battlefields of the Hundred Years' Oil War that has devastated Iraq and Iran. More pretentious freedom-related explanations will seem irrelevant. For now, though, it is hard to imagine travel posters for Fallujah, Nasiriyah, Mosul, or the steamy Shatt el-Arab, the estuary of the combined Tigris and Euphrates near Kuwait. But the hundred-year duration is clear enough. The subject matter was indeed oil, and English speakers, British, Americans, Australians, New Zealanders, were invariably among the arms-bearers. Americans wound up as the leaders, but the epic began in 1897, when a nervous local sheikh asked the British to assume a protectorate over Kuwait, then a minor outpost of Turkish Mesopotamia. With oil widely reported in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, Germany had begun the Berlin-Baghdad Railway, hoping to negotiate for Kuwait as its Persian Gulf terminus. The British took it first. By 1914, the Germans had negotiated oil rights as far as Mosul, as Britain had for Kuwait, which at that time had less promise. When war broke out, Turkish Mesopotamia quickly became a battleground, and British units slowly moved upriver from Basra. They fought through Nazariya and Kant, losing badly at first, but eventually overcoming German-led Turkish troops. Luckily for the British War Office, the first local German commander, Field Marshal Kolmar von der Goltz, a crack strategist who beat them at Ctesiphon and Kut, died of typhus in 1916. Realizing the future stakes, British and French diplomats made a secret arrangement in 1916, the Sykes-Picot Agreement mentioned earlier, for a post-war split of oil-rich Mesopotamia. The Mosul region to be under France, the rest under Britain. However, deciding that they needed Mosul too, British troops kept fighting after the November 1918 armistice, captured the city in December, and installed themselves. Other satisfactions were provided for the French, notably accepting that they might occupy portions of defeated Germany. In 1922, Turkey sought to take back Mosul from Britain, but failed. Lord Curzon, Foreign Secretary, famously insisted that the influence of oil on British policy was nil. Oil, he said, had not the remotest connection with my attitude, nor with that of His Majesty's government over Mosul. Mocked in Parliament and the press, Curzon ultimately took to the pages of the Times in 1924 to plead his case, but most historians have scoffed at his claim. There is something about oil that makes high officials lie. Despite several promises of self-determination to the Arabs, a 1920 rebellion in Iraq caused the British to tighten control through a surprising and unprecedented instrument, the fledgling Royal Air Force. According to Stephen Pelletier, professor at the U.S. Army War College, this was the first known use of air power as a constabulary. In time, the British expanded the use of the RAF, sending it on all sorts of assignments. For example, it would bomb the tribes to soften them up for visits from the tax collector. Controversy persisted, but so did the RAF. Iraqis, in turn, repeatedly rose up. One Iraqi historian recorded 30 significant violent outbreaks of some sort between 1919 and 1958, when the British finally left Iraq. 1941 brought a new menace into the oil wars. In pursuit of both petroleum supplies and Middle East hegemony, German troops moved into Egypt and threatened Cairo. Berlin simultaneously pressured the collaborationist Vichy French regime in Syria to help seize control of next-door Iraq. For a month or so in May 1941, German and Italian aircraft, Heinkel bombers, Messerschmitts, and Savoia Marchettis, pounded the British airfield at Habaniya, 60 miles from the capital, in support of a pro-German Iraqi faction that had prosecuted a successful coup in Baghdad. Fierce fighting also raged around Fallujah, a scene revisited 62 years later. However, the pro-German Rashid Ali clique soon fled to Persia as British relief columns advanced from Palestine and, once more, upriver from Basra. The Iraqi campaigns of two world wars are reasonably well documented in Britain and have been the backdrop for some fascinating novels. So is the long history of British regional pursuit of oil. Likewise, well understood is the British government's usual preoccupation with oil and geopolitics, not democracy, although few Americans recall either set of precedents. This may help to explain why Prime Minister Blair's pretenses that oil was not involved in 2003 were dismissed by the British press, while the U.S. media generally spared George W. Bush's assurances. The first half century set the patterns. First, oil has always been a central motive of Western attempts, German, British, Russian, American, to invade Iraq or Iran or overthrow a local government. Second, oil geography has made the Persian Gulf and Tigris-Euphrates Valley into one of the region's great military corridors. Arguments for an oil-premised 100 years oil war have been made by James A. Paul of the UN-based Global Policy Forum, by Swiss journalist William Engdahl in A Century of War, and less categorically by Stephen Pelletier in his political chronicle Iraq and the International Oil System. The span seems compelling, but it inconveniently undercuts most of the Anglo-American pretenses raised in 2002 and 2003. Washington practitioners of realpolitik posit a shorter, America-centered 30 years war, starting in 1973, when James Schlesinger, Secretary of Defense in the Nixon administration, contacted senior British officials about joining the United States in a joint airborne attack to seize the oil fields in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi. The immediate source of American frustration was the 1973 to 1974 Israel-Arab War and the related Arab and OPEC embargo on oil shipments to the United States and the Netherlands. The British were cool to the possible 1973 attack, but then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger returned to the same theme 2 years later in an article written under a nom de plume for Harper's Magazine. In 2002, as the United States prepared for war, James Akins, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1973 to 1975, recalled how the Harper's article laid out a case for the United States, solving its oil problem by seizing Saudi oil fields and installations. He alleged that Kissinger had also promoted the idea to journalists in a deep background briefing. Of the war about to start in 2003, Akins said, "It's the Kissinger plan. I thought it had been killed, but it's back." In either British or American chronology, it is impossible to fully separate Iraq from Kuwait, which was carved out of Iraq, or Iran, which shares an 800-mile border with Iraq. After World War II, when Washington gained precedence within the Western alliance, the American CIA, not British intelligence, stage-managed the 1953 overthrow of elected Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. His principal transgression had been to nationalize the British-owned Anglo-Iranian oil company, although Washington also feared Soviet influence. Under the restored Shah, Reza Pahlavi, Iran then became a client state principally of the United States. Anglo-Iranian oil, although readmitted at the head of a new consortium, was obliged to yield a 40% share to U.S. oil firms. Recently, it has come to light that U.S. intelligence also planned a coup in 1959 against Iraqi Prime Minister Abdul Karim Qasim, like Mossadegh, a nationalist. The effort, which came to naught, allegedly included hiring a 22-year-old named Saddam Hussein. By the 1960s, the strategic importance of the entire Persian Gulf to the United States had been defined and upheld by a series of presidents beginning with Franklin D. Roosevelt. The underpinning for each expression of White House concern was just what had motivated Whitehall: oil. The events since 1973 are reasonably well known. In 1979, Iranian radicals overthrew the Shah, taking 53 American embassy employees hostage. President Carter's helicopter rescue mission to get them back failed, but they were released on the day in 1981 when Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. Between 1980 and 1988, as Iraq and Iran fought a war over boundary issues with a subtext of oil geography, the United States, Britain, and several other nations were selling arms to both sides. At the same time, Washington and London cooperated in clandestine arrangements to provide Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein with dual-use materials that facilitated Iraq's pursuit of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. William Safire, the New York Times columnist and former Republican White House aide, labeled the behavior of the United States, Britain, and Italy as Iraqgate, and refused to support George H.W. Bush for re-election in 1992 because of his backstairs involvement in it. In retrospect, the two Iraq wars of 1991 and 2003 displayed striking parallels. Both Iraqgate and the 2002-2003 imbroglio over alleged weapons of mass destruction produced lackluster investigations in Washington, by congressional bodies, and London, by law lords. Both invasions were lubricated by deceits. In the first instance, regarding the Iraqi armored threat to Saudi Arabia and the fabrication that Iraqi invaders had ripped 300 premature Kuwaiti babies from hospital incubators. In the second, involving the unsustainable charges that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Former CIA desk officer Pelletier minces few words on this, saying that the behavior of the Americans and British in the run-ups to both wars bore a disturbing similarity to the big lie used by the Germans in launching World War II. At very least, both governments have been deceitful toward their respective publics. They are manipulative towards them to an extreme degree. Unfortunately, as we can see, this behavior goes back nearly a century. While both governments have talked of Arab freedom and self-determination, the reality has more often involved a chorus of onward Christian soldiers, or onward oil producers, with a persistent allegro of punitive aerial bombing. Perhaps the last word should go to the late scholar Edward Said. Every single empire, in its official discourse, has said that it is not like all the others, that its circumstances are special, that it has a mission to enlighten, civilize, bring order and democracy, and that it uses force only as a last resort. The real map of Iraq. In Baghdad's Iraqi National Museum, left wide open to looters in 2003 by careless U.S. military planners, dozens of wall maps explained Iraq's achievements as the cradle of world civilization. Its invention of writing and the wheel, the birth of mathematics, and the establishment of the first code of laws, Hammurabi's. By most archaeologists' accounts, the museum and the National Library were world-class institutions with unique collections. Even so, the first major building to be surrounded and occupied by American soldiers was the one housing truly vital maps and artifacts, the Iraqi Oil Ministry. Here were thousands of seismic portraits of the nation's oil fields, the subterranean keys to Majnun, northern Ramallah, west Kurna, and many more. World opinion had little difficulty in mistaking U.S. priorities. Primitive oil-related cartography may go back to ancient times, since the area in and around Iraq held the world's oldest oil culture. To the north was Azerbaijan, Persian for Garden of Fire. In Iraq and Iran, governments as early as the 800s appointed a Wali al-Naft, or oil minister, in each region to control, regulate, and tax production. The Persian province of Fars, according to 10th-century records, paid an annual tribute of 90 metric tons of oil to light the palace of the caliph. Nevertheless, the oldest relevant map of Iraqi oil fields seems to be the one that ran in the Petroleum Review of May 23, 1914, under the attention-getting caption, "The Petroleum Deposits of Mesopotamia, a Second Baku in the Making." Both oil and asphalt fields were included, as was the Berlin-Baghdad Railway, which Britons feared might give Germany the edge in future regional development. Presumably, even more detailed maps were used by French and British negotiators to plot their wartime division of post-war Mesopotamia. From the 1930s to the 1960s, in the words of oil historian Anthony Sampson, the reorganized Middle East had two kinds of maps, some showing the names and outlines of the nations, most of them comparatively new, and others showing the region cut up into squares along the coast, marked with the initials IPC, KOC, Aramco, AOC, representing the consortia of oil companies, nearly always including some of the Seven Sisters. To the companies, it was these squares which were the real geography. Saudi Arabia was Aramco land. Iran meant all the seven. Kuwait was Gulf and BP. The oil maps, in short, had long been the ones that mattered. For the U.S. and British oil companies, losing these concessions to the nationalizations of the 1970s was infuriating. The irony with respect to Iraq was that, for one reason or another, the 1970s were the only decade of heavy pumping and large oil revenues. Production had been kept low during the glutted 30s, and it then stagnated during World War II. By 1948, Iraq's commercial production was just one-seventh that of Iran and one-sixth that of Saudi Arabia. Then between 1980 and 1988, the drawn-out Iran-Iraq War curbed output in both countries. Next came the Gulf War in 1991, followed by the effects of United Nations sanctions from 1990 until the subsequent invasion of Iraq in 2003. Over the last decade or so, this chronology of Iraq's surprisingly limited oil production has become relevant again for a simple reason. Given that relatively little of Iraq's oil has been pumped, most of it is still in the ground. As the dust of the first Gulf War settled, oil companies from Texas to China began wondering which among them would gain access when the United Nations sanctions were lifted. By 1995, the Wall Street Journal and other publications were reporting the American fear that if Saddam Hussein could escape UN sanctions and give Iraq's lush concessions to non-Anglo-American companies, he could realign the global oil business. In the meantime, UN sanctions were essential in preventing Iraq from exporting oil beyond the middling amount allowed and also in preventing competitive foreign investments. So long as the United States and Britain could keep these sanctions in place, using allegations concerning weapons of mass destruction, Saddam could not implement his own plan to extend large-scale oil concessions, estimated to be worth $1.1 trillion, to French, Russian, Chinese, and other oil companies. Most analysts concluded that he hoped to enlist those three nations, which had seats on the UN Security Council, to get the sanctions lifted. As the buzzards circled, Iraq became the prize piece needed to complete three interrelated Washington jigsaw puzzles: the rebuilding of Anglo-American oil company reserves, transformation of Iraq into an oil protectorate-cum-military base, and reinforcement of the global hegemony of the U.S. dollar. This brings us to the next critical set of maps, the ones used in 2001 by Vice President Dick Cheney's National Energy Policy Development Group to mesh America's energy needs with a 21st century national security blueprint. This group pursued a mandate, in collaboration with the National Security Council, to deal with rogue states and actions regarding the capture of new and existing oil and gas fields. Never intended for public scrutiny, the three Middle East maps and their supporting documents came to light in the summer of 2003 under a federal court order. The most pertinent displayed Iraq's oil fields, pipelines, and refineries, with a supporting list of foreign suitors for Iraqi oil field contracts. As of 2001, more than 60 firms from 30 countries, most prominently France, Russia, and China, but also India, Japan, Indonesia, Canada, and Germany, had projects either agreed upon or under discussion with Baghdad. Nothing could have been less popular in Washington or London. Canadian writer Linda McQuaig of the Toronto Star offered this juicy description. The Southwest is neatly divided, for instance, into nine exploration blocks. Stripped of political trappings, this map shows a naked Iraq with only its ample natural assets in view. It's like a supermarket meat chart, which identifies various parts of a slab of beef so customers can see the most desirable cuts. Block one might be the strip loin. Block two and block three are perhaps some juicy tenderloin, but block eight... that could be the filet mignon. The French oil giant Total was to get the 25-billion-barrel Majnoun oil field. There goes the filet mignon into the mouths of the French. What these maps left unsaid was how relatively untouched, or at least untapped, the Iraqi fields were. But Cheney's team would presumably have studied the history of Iraqi oil output. Since the turn of the 20th century, later explained Leonardo Magheri, a senior vice president at the Italian oil and gas company ENI, only 2,300 wells have been drilled in Iraq, compared with about 1 million in Texas. A large part of the country, the western desert area, is still mainly unexplored. Iraq has never implemented advanced technologies, like 3D seismic exploration techniques or deep and horizontal drilling, to find or tap new wells. Of more than 80 oil fields discovered in Iraq, only about 21 have been at least partially developed. It is realistic to assume that Iraq has far more oil reserves than documented so far, probably about 200 billion barrels more. Not a few geologists suspected that the former Mesopotamia might have more left than Saudi Arabia. Fadel Geit, a prominent New York-based oil analyst, used words more appropriate to a movie publicist. Think of Iraq as virgin territory. This is bigger than anything Exxon is involved in currently. It is the superstar of the future. That's why Iraq becomes the most sought-after real estate on the face of the earth. Think of Iraq as a military base with a very large oil reserve underneath. You can't ask for better than that. Defining American Petro-Imperialism. Old-fashioned colonialists, regal and unembarrassed, took physical control of territories, sent in ostrich-plumed governors, minted coins, and printed local postage stamps on which kings or queens gazed proudly over scenes of natives cutting cocoa pods or harvesting.